Thank you for being here. I see a lot of familiar faces and some new ones, and I'm really, really happy to see everyone. My name is Angie Finn, and I call myself a horse listener. And that is because, as I'm going to share with you today, I have learned so much from horses, but I've learned by listening to them, not by whispering to them or telling them anything. It's what horses have told me, and EFT has been a facilitating modality for that, that I want to share with you today. And so I'm the warm-up act for the beautiful and talented Ann Robbins, who will talk to you about dogs. So we're going to split the time, so if dogs is your thing, you will get dogs too. Meanwhile, I hope too that by the end of my presentation that you all are as goofy in love with horses as I am, hopefully. So horses really are the reason I'm here today, and I don't mean by that it's because I'm here to talk about horses. Horses are the reason I'm here today because I found out about EFT because of horses. And if I had not taken up riding when I was 50 and wanted to compete on my horse and wanted some mental sport techniques that would help me in the show ring with my horse, I might never have found out about EFT. But I did. I learned about it from a dressage coach named Jane Savoy and said, what's this EFT thing? Started researching it, got hooked immediately, and just went off from there. And of course it's helped me with my horse competition, but it's really helped me with my whole life. But because I love doing EFT with horses and with riders, that has been sort of a special love for me, to use it that way. That is not all that my practice is, but that is a very, very special part of my practice. So I'm really happy to share with you today why that is so important to me and so special to me. Now, before I do that, I just want to ask for some input, because I have my friends and family can tell you that I talk about horses all the time and all day long, and you can't stop me. So I really want to make sure that I cover, though, what you want to hear about. So tell me, who here is interested in specifics? What are the tapping points? How do I tap with a horse? What are the signs of relaxation? Who here is interested in that? Show of hands. Okay. And who here is interested in, I'm an animal lover and I would just love to hear beautiful stories about horses and riders and that, right, okay, and wonderful things that have happened as a result. And me listening to a horse. Okay, oh, awesome. Okay, good. Well, we'll cover all of those. And you do have your handy-dandy little tapping point sheet, so I'll spend a little time going over that, but I won't spend a whole bunch of time. And I want you guys to notice on the back of your sheet is your Pictionary about the signals that horses give with their ears. And this is one way you can listen to horses, by watching their ears. I see Ann nodding, so maybe we'll get the analog on dogs. This is my beloved mare, Miss Chip. She posed for this picture, so she's helping us out here. So I think there are two ways that you can work with horses' energy, help them balance their energy and release their energy and come into their own coherence and balance. And one of those, of course, is by working on a horse, tapping on them and doing other kinds of energy work. I do chakra clearing on them too. But the other way is by working with a horse's human. So that is incredibly important to remember, that we can do energy work on horses, and it's wonderfully rewarding. I always borrow benefits when I work with the horse. But we can also help the horse so much by helping the horse's human, their owner, their rider, their trainer. And so if we only focus on, well, I want to do energy work with animals, and I'm going to work on the animals, or I'm going to surrogate work on the animals, we might be missing that very important pathway in our energy work. So today I'll be talking about a little bit of both, how I've worked with humans and how that's benefited their horses, and it's a two-way street, of course, and how I've worked directly on horses. So I'll leave a little time for questions at the end of my section before I turn it over to Anne. So the reason I think horses are wonderful animals to work with, besides being goofy in love with them, is that they are like living metaphors for us. And they are incredibly sensitive. If you listened to John's presentation this morning about heart math, they've done some of the same work. A heart math trained equine researcher worked with horses and humans together to see how that worked out with coherence and with heart feels. And a horse's heart is much bigger than ours, and it beats much more slowly than ours. So when we are around horses, we come into our own coherence, but of course our heart rate stays in a human range. It doesn't go as low as a horse's range. But because their heart is big and beats slowly, it casts an enormous heart field compared to a human. Come on in. So when we are in the presence of horses, we do tend to come into our coherence. That goes both ways. What she found in her research was that when horses feel humans begin to move into coherence in that heart-mouth sense, their bioenergetic field registers that in a way that can be measured. So their sensitivity allows them to pick up, and all animals have that sensitivity, right? So horses have this incredible sensitivity, allows them to pick this up from us. She even had one situation where when a human was in an arena with a horse who's at liberty, so the horse can go anywhere they want, and the human sends feelings of appreciation to the horse would turn and look at them as much as 20 feet away. They would turn and look at the human when the human sent appreciative feelings toward them. So why horses? Why am I so crazy about how sensitive they are and how they can be our living metaphors? Well, because they're big. They're really big in terms of our companion animals, in terms of the animals that most of us will ever be around. They are probably one of the bigger companion animals that we'll actually have an opportunity to be around. So when they are sensitive and they pick up something from us and they show us big time. It's like being on a jumbotron when they show us our stuff. It's like, oh my gosh, oh, didn't realize it was that big. Because they can't help but act it out. They're not like us. They're not going to sit around at Starbucks and talk about it for several hours, right? No, when they feel it, they're going to act on it. They're going to act it out. They can't help but. So in order to illustrate that, I'd like to tell you a story of one of my clients, Beebs. I let her pick her own stage name, and it was Beebs, which I just love, and her horse, Bubba. And Beebs contacted me because Bubba was rearing every time she came into his enclosure to work with him. He was rearing up. Now, if you know horse behavior, you will know that that is an extreme reaction for a horse. It's a very defensive reaction, and it's very dangerous for the horse and for the human. And so you might think, well, my gosh, what was she doing? You know, coming in with a whip. But no, Beebs was not that kind of person. She was not doing dangerous or frightening or cruel work with her horse. She didn't want to do that. She wanted to saddle him up and take him for trail rides and an occasional lesson in the arena. So his reaction was highly disproportionate to what she was actually doing. And it had gotten so bad that she couldn't really handle him, and she found me. And she made a Skype appointment with me, and then she found out how to do EFT from my website, and she went and started working with her horse on her own before we ever worked together, and started seeing some improvement in his behavior at that point. So, you know, that was wonderful. By the time of our first session, she's like, yeah, Bubba's already kind of better. You know, this is very exciting. So when we were determining what to work on and what her goals were, obviously her goal was to be able to work with her horse safely again and have him be a partner to her, and they could go out on trail rides again. And the first thing we worked on was her first serious horseback riding accident when she had just, not on Bubba, it was on a different horse, and when she had just started riding, just learning to ride, just doing the trail rides, and she had been out with friends, and it was a beautiful day. She really vividly remembers how beautiful the day was and how much fun they had. And then something happened, you know, something scared the horses. They began to run a bit, and the horse she was riding, which was rather unfamiliar to her, she hadn't ridden much, this horse reared up with her on its back. And she has one memory of, wow, this is a lot of power, before she let go of the reins, slipped down from the horse, and lost consciousness. When she regained consciousness and she was injured, her friends told her, he fell over on you. So Well, of course, EFT can work on that, right? We cleared that, the traumatic memories of that trail ride in that first session. And you won't be surprised to hear that she went back and things were better with Bubba from that first session. But what I want to think about today, what I want all of us to be thinking about today, is what was her horse doing when she went into his enclosure? Her horse, not the horse that she had been on 5 years earlier. Her horse, Bubba, was rearing up. He was literally telling her where her work was that needed to be done. He was showing her. Rearing up. That's right. That's right. I mean, you can't get more literal than that, right? And it was about trail riding. She wanted to trail ride, which is where the accident happened. So I love this story, and we had several other incident, you know, sessions. We did sessions for quite a while, and we had several other wonderful stories as well. But I love this story because it shows how our horses will tell us what we need to work on, where our work is. That's what I mean by Jumbotron. And to my knowledge, she's had, you know, more and less feeling of partnership with him, but he's never done that again. And they've been able to trail ride successfully, even some fairly intimidating trail rides and some where they'd had problems before. So it was a wonderful outcome for her. And I'm sure that Bubba is much happier as well. And another story that I'd like to tell that gives you a similar idea about how horses will show us where our work is and what needs to be done is about a current client. And I will call her Jay. And Jay is a very competent executive who never met a problem she couldn't handle until her child was diagnosed with a very serious disease about 8 years ago. And up until that time, she had been a rider. She had been a competitor. She was, you know, just one of these women that gets things done. And when her child was diagnosed, they went into long-term treatment. In the meantime, she lost her horse her horse that belonged to her that she'd raised from a baby that she was competing on. He passed away. But she was consumed with the treatment of her child. So, okay, it's 8 years later. Her child is doing well. Her health, the child's health is good, and she's back to riding. Jay is. And she's having problems. This is a new horse. This is a lesson horse. She's having problems on the horse. And I need to give you a little bit of technical rider lingo here. The problem she's having is called blocking the horse's forward motion. Meaning, as she's sitting and riding her horse, her body is tense enough and in such a position that it makes it hard for the horse to move forward with fluidity. So it's not literally blocking the horse from moving forward, but from moving forward with ease and fluidity and grace. And so that's what she came to me for, having problems riding, and I want to, you know, relax. I can't get in the right spot in the saddle and so forth. Now, she was very aware that there was stuff coming up from the 8 years of her child's treatment and that was part of what was going on, right? So we worked together for a few sessions, including one in the arena with this beautiful lesson mare that she's riding. Very gentle, very loving. This horse's heart field was huge. Just such a beautiful spirit. And then in about our second phone session, Jay came to this, she had a breakthrough. She came to this realization. She said, I have been trying to protect my child from anything bad since this started, and I feel it in my chest, and I'm trying to hold her. And her aha moment was, I can't hold my child. I must let my child go. So that was beautiful for her. She really appreciated coming to that realization. And in her next ride a few days later, she had a breakthrough on her horse. And guess what her breakthrough was? Well, first I need to back up and tell you that one of the things that accompanied her breakthrough about her situation with her child was that she said, I have a feeling of space in my chest that I don't recall ever feeling before. It's the first time I really have ever felt this. So she gets on her horse a couple of days later, and we talked about a week after that, and she said, I had a breakthrough. I was able to lift my rib cage off the horse. Obviously, she wasn't in contact with the horse, but lift myself, you know, create enough space, lift my ribcage off the horse, and the horse was able to move forward. I know. So, just for the recording, that was a big ah in the room. I know. How cool is that? And so she was able to put all that together and, you know, think about it. she realized that she was blocking her child's forward motion. Her presenting problem was she was blocking her horse's forward motion. And through that particular tapping session where she had her breakthrough, she realized she was blocking her own forward motion. She was blocking everything's forward motion. So once she got that space in her chest, she had that breakthrough ride on her mare who said, "Yeah, I can do this. Where do you want me to put my feet now? You know, now that you're not blocking me, where should I put my feet?" Which created a feeling of wobbliness, as she put her, as Jay said, in the horse. She said she felt kind of wobbly. And the instructor said, "Yeah, that's because she was asking, where do you want me to put my feet? You've never let me really move this well before." So in the third phone session we had where she was telling me about all this, she said, "And that feeling of wobbliness, that kind of parallels how I feel, because I'm changing patterns that I've held on to for a long time, and I feel a little wobbly." Like, she didn't say it, but she said, I was thinking, like, you don't know where to put your feet, right? So this is the beauty of working, as I said, with the, not just one way to clear a horse's energy by working on a horse. This is the beauty of working with the human, and that clears things for the horse. And this is the beauty for the human that the horse can show them in real life, in three dimensions, in big, powerful three dimensions, what needs to be worked on, and then what happens when you clear it and when you work on it. So that's a couple of stories that illustrate how wonderful it is when a horse is tell us what we need to work on, we do work on it, and then the horse tells us, "Hey, awesome job, you got it. I can do my job now. I can relax." Horses want to be in balance. You know, all animals want to be in balance, is my belief. We humans, with that big prefrontal cortex that Jean was talking about, we're the ones that hang on to being not in balance. So very rarely have I worked with a horse when I was doing energy work directly with a horse. Very rarely have I worked with a horse where the horse didn't seem to want to let go. Maybe they're distracted. That's a different issue. Maybe they are severely traumatized, and that's a pretty serious issue. But if things are in the fairly decent middle range there, human perspective from a 3 to a 7, that horse will release it pretty quickly, 15 to 20 minutes. If I work longer than that, it's just because I'm enjoying myself. I'm borrowing benefits from the horse. One of the first times I tapped with this mare, whose picture you have on the handout sheet, she was new to me, and I was tapping with her. We'd ridden a little bit. We weren't in a great partnership yet, and so I began tapping with her. I tapped with her the first time I met her, the first time I got her, but I was tapping on, you know, releasing some of our partnership struggles. And after probably 5 minutes, maybe 10 minutes, she lowered her head, which is a sign of relaxation in horses. She lowered her head, and she put her third eye right next to my heart. So her face was facing me this way, and her third eye area was right next to my heart area. And we just stood that way for what seemed like 50 years. We stood that way. And it was one of those moments out of time. I don't know, it's probably 2 or 3 minutes. But those are the kind of energy, that's what I think of when I think of listening to my horse. Those are the kind of energy exchanges that we can have. So I'd like to, before I go over briefly the tapping points for you and how to know when a horse is relaxing, I'd like to tell you one last story about working directly on horses. And this is one of my favorite stories because it wraps so many things up all together. I was working with a horse I'll call Slick. I had not worked with his humans. I never met his humans. He had anxiety issues. He was not working well in his current condition. And so I'd been doing some tapping on Slick, and he really liked it. He really responded well to it. So I went out one day to get him out of the pasture. I was going to take him to a small enclosure, what we call a round pen, which is a large round area where the horse can move at liberty, but he's not so far that he can really get too far away from you. So I went to get Slick. I had the halter and the lead rope, and I go out there. Well, on this day, there's a new horse in the herd that he ran with. And this horse, I'll call him Boss, because he was new to the herd. I'd never seen him before, and he had taken his job as bossing Slick around. So he was Slick's boss, and so I went out there with an agenda and not very much time, which is really dangerous when you're working with horses, so because it's never going to work. So I went out there, not much time, my agenda. I had an agenda. I need to get him haltered and out of here. Boss had an agenda. I need to keep Slick away from her at all costs. and I will do it. And so we had this little, didn't take long, but we had this little contest, and guess who won? Boss, yeah, because he had four legs, and he's about 1,300 pounds, and Slick was already used to listening to Boss, right? So I quickly became flexible, and I changed my agenda, and flexibility is good in life, and it's good in EFT, right? And it's good with horses, too. And I changed my agenda. I'm just going to put a halter on this horse and tap with him right here in the field. So I finally got us all lined up. I was here. Slick was next to me, and Boss was on the other side. We're all facing, I don't even know how I did that. That was a miracle. We're all facing together. I did that so I could tell this story today. We're all facing the same direction, and I began to tap on Slick. And Slick didn't do what he usually did. He didn't relax. His head stayed up, and he had that 1,000-yard stare in his eyes. But you know what I noticed? On the other side of Slick, Boss was starting to relax. Wow. Boss's head was starting to go down. He was starting to lick and chew, which is a motion that they make with their jaw and with their tongue. Too bad this isn't videoed, right? So that you can tell that they're thinking and or relaxing. So Boss is relaxing. So I'm like, okay. So I reach under Slick's neck and around his chest, and I start tapping on Boss's chest a little bit, you know, and that's really working. And Slick even relaxes a teensy bit. So enough that I can get the halter on him. And so I thought, well, this has worked so well. I think I will take Slick up to the front, to the gate, and then I'll unhalter him and let him go away. In behavioristic terms, behavioral science terms, right, it's reward him for coming along with me, and he gets to go free, and he gets rewarded for coming with me nicely. So I did, and we started up there. Boss came along. Boss is at liberty. But Boss, we had now formed a little tiny herd of three, with about, you know, 2 minutes of tapping. And we're walking up there, and at a certain point, Slick stops. And I'm worried that Boss is going to hurt him and that Slick will overreact and pull out of my hands and run loose, and that would be a bad thing. So Boss sure enough started to make the herding move, which is to come around to his back and use his head to tell him to go on. So I wasn't trusting this situation at this point. So I stopped everybody. I tapped on Boss. And I tapped on Slick, got everybody moving forward again. So about two horse lengths from the gate, Slick plants his feet and will not go forward for nothing. No, none of my tricks worked. Nothing was going to get this horse all the way to the gate. And Boss is like watching. Yeah. And so finally, in frustration, I turned to Boss and I said, look, I just want to get him to the gate, and then I'll take the halter off and I'll let him go. And Boss looked at me, he walked over to Slick, and he bumped him gently on the shoulder with his head, and we three walked to the gate. I know. I know. So I took the halter off, because you got to keep your promises. I took the halter off, I thanked them both very genuinely, and then I just let this wash over me, this feeling of awe and amazement at what a little bit of tapping and horse listening can do. Because had I missed that opportunity, had I only focused on Slick and missed Boss's signs of relaxation, had I not trusted Boss to do what, you know, I asked him to do, the whole thing would have failed, in my opinion, would have failed. So that's just one of my favorite examples of coming into entrainment and attunement with horses and their incredible sensitivity. So I am going to leave time for a couple of questions, but I just want to let you know the tapping points are on this page. I'm happy to talk to you afterwards if you're interested about which points work better. The chest point is usually the one I start with. It works on almost every horse. The head points are a little trickier. And then the mouth points, some horses like them great, some horses not so much. So if you're really interested in specifically how to tap, just see me afterwards and we will talk about that. And I do have a sign-up sheet at the speaker table. I would love for you to sign up for my email newsletter, and I'll send you a tip sheet, a written tip sheet on working with horses. So questions, anybody? I'll be around later. Yes? I've never worked with rabbits. But I was going to say, but I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised. And Nancy, ask me later. Okay. I do have some surrogate stories. Yes, yes. Thank you for that. Always, always approach a horse from the side. As predators, we approach straight on with a very hard gaze. normally. A horse reads that as a predatory attack. So you want to come sort of sidewise to them in sort of a curving manner, and I would start around where their neck meets their shoulder with just a hand there. That's a chakra point for horses. And then I would start with some tapping on the chest, and I would work my way up, trying the head if you feel that that's indicated. And if you don't, back off and go back to the chest and try again. Yeah. Yes, because I know about the sensitivity of the field, I will start about 30 feet away from them, 20 feet away from them, if they're at liberty. If they're in a stall, I'll just stand outside the stall, and I'll just talk to them, just softly talk to them. Yeah. You know, I should have been saying this, the question. So the question here is, are there verbal signs of relaxation in a horse? And yes, here they are quickly. Lowering of the head, the eye softening, just like ours would do. If you see white around the eyes, it's a very bad sign. The ears calming down, ears back on the neck, very bad sign. Get out of the way fast. Ears way forward, they're not paying much attention to you, but ears sort of to the side and relaxing is a sign. They will do... That's a sign of relaxation. They will shake their head and sometimes their entire body. If there aren't many flies, that's probably a sign of relaxation too. They will cock a back hip. You've seen a horse standing like this with one back leg or the other. That's a sign of relaxation. And as I mentioned, the licking, chewing motion. Those are all signs of relaxation in a horse. So in general, you can feel it. Yes. No, that's a really interesting question. I shouldn't say no. The question is, am I verbalizing when I'm tapping? When I first started, I did because I was kind of doing classic EFT. But, you know, I've found that the verbalizing is more important for me than for the horse. So I don't do much anymore. And if I feel a little stuck, I might throw words in there. But I just tap and watch. And watching is what I call listening. Tap and watch and feel what I'm noticing. And sometimes feel like my hands are guided to tap a certain place a little more than others, and I just take that as information. So, yeah. I work a lot with pain and physical issues. It can work for emotional balance like Slick. I was talking about, the instructor actually asked me if I would work with Slick because of his issues. And so I work a lot with physical issues, but it's really just sort of whatever presents itself. Yes, if someone says, my horse is this, can you help with that? Then I'll just go in and tap. And I consider tapping to really primarily be a conversation with the horse. It's how we get to know each other. So somebody once coaching me said, oh, you healers, you're all alike. You want to heal everybody and you want to do energy work on them. But in reality, the way I look at it as, this is how I get acquainted with animals. I just do some, I don't necessarily expect something out of it. I just do some tapping and just see what happens. Unless someone has asked me to do a specific problem. But more for pain. Like recently I tapped on a horse who had injured her leg in the trailer and helped her calm down from the injury so that she could begin to recover. Yeah. And her owner rode her the next day. So, yeah. So thank you so much. I will be around. Be happy to. Oh, what? Do what? I think I have seen it, yeah.
Making contact with it and then allowing contact and touching
from the child. Yes. Yes. Yes.
It was really beyond my ability to make the words come into my brain, but as a parent, yes, that was also a question.
Yes.
Yes.
Letting a child in. Letting a child with a particular disability in there with them. Of course, if you know your horse, knowing your horse is very important. But it's... you watch the horse for the signs that I've been talking about. Curiosity, relaxation, no drawing back, no raised head. But horses, this sensitivity I mentioned, they are innately amazing about knowing what can, you know, when they need to be supportive and when they need to be self-protective. And a quick example, because I just got the one-minute sign. I was riding my horse in a competition, this mare that you have in your lap, in a competition, and we were not doing that well. She was very tense, and I was very tense. We were not doing that well. And an eight-year-old was scheduled to ride her also in their age class. And the trainer was looking at what my horse was doing and going, I don't think this is a good idea. I don't think this is a good idea. And I had talked to Miss Chip. I had already talked to her and told her what was going to happen, because I do that all the time. And we put the girl on her, and I watched, and I said, you know what? This is going to work fine. Don't worry about it. And they went into the ring, and it was flawless. It was absolutely flawless. The horse took perfect care of the little girl. Whereas with me, we were fighting the whole way around. So, yeah. We're not doing that anymore. I just need to throw that in. So they have amazing sensitivity to know when they need to connect in that way and what someone needs. Yeah. So thank you, guys. I'm happy to answer questions afterwards. And now, the person you've all been waiting for, Anne Robbins.
Okay, my thing today, of course, is about dogs. Just a little bit about me. I've been training dogs for over 50 years. And I've sort of seen, over the course of 50 years, a lot of changes in how people approach animals in general, but dogs in particular. And we've sort of gone from, like in general, where people had a sort of coercive approach to animals, master, servant type approach, you know, I'm the one who's got, you know, I've got the leash and there's a choke collar on the other end, so it's going to go my way, to, you know, some very winky blinky stuff, and then like some training techniques that are really all about everything being positive. And I mean, if you have ever dealt with a child or any other human thing, any other animal, any mammal, nothing is ever always positive, ever. So my approach to animals really is pretty much as it is when we practice EFT, is we meet that being where they are. And as Angie said, you know, watching and doing an assessment is probably the very, very first step. Has to be. Let me just talk a little bit about how I came to understand that there was an energetic, a purely energetic connection between dogs and humans. And for those of you who have heard this before, sorry to repeat the story, but it's just a great story. So this is back probably in 2003, and I was hired by the Port Authority of New York to do rehabilitation on a very, very expensive dog. They had imported to do scent work for contraband, for bombs, for drugs, for all kinds of things. They had paid an enormous amount of money for this dog, who happened to be a three-year-old Belgian Malinois. He was a very big dog, you know, for that particular breed. I don't know if you know what they look like. They sort of look like German Shepherds, but golden, tawny-coated. There's not a lot of extra anything on a Malinois. It's like you can't grab skin. There's nothing extra or loose about them. And they have a black mask. Very good-looking dog. So this particular dog that I was hired to rehabilitate had bitten three handlers and sent two of them to the hospital. And it was always the same kind of bite. On a tall man who had been handling them, you know, all the way across, he would come across, you know, being walked on the left, he would come across, hit the thigh, and then come up through the face. So, I mean, this is a dog who, you know, he meant business, for real. So I went out, I watched the dog at liberty in a pen, you know, approached the dog carefully, respectfully, just trying to get a sense of what was going on. I mean, really, what was going on? So they opened up the pen. We put a leash on the dog. He had just a normal like slip-type collar on. And we started walking around a concrete enclosure with very, very high chain link, and there was razor wire on the top. It was not really a happy-looking place, but it wasn't a bad place to work. So, going down one side, okay, make the turn. About two steps into the turn, the most subtle change came over the dog, where he was just more forward, slightly up on the toes, chest lifted, and that flash of when a dog is giving you stink eye, which is, the white, all of a sudden shows just a little bit. And then this was my response. All I saw was red. And that's like my personal, in a hurry, red. Like, this is red zone. Big problem. And what I was really thinking was, oh, holy crap, this dog is going to come up the leash at me. And sure enough, as soon as I had that red, this is what's going to happen. He came up, and he didn't even bother to go for my thigh because I was short. He came right up for my face. And I grabbed him, both sides of his neck. And like I said, there's not a lot to hang on to with a dog like that. And that began the most epic battle with a dog that I've ever had. It lasted about 25 minutes, where I had him. He was trying to wrap my legs. He was huge jaws snapping, literally. I mean, I had dog spit all over my face. It was really, truly, truly terrifying. And so this began the process. I would think to myself, oh, geez, I'm too old for this, right? And he would get stronger. And then I would think, oh, this is a dog. You've done this your whole life. You got to make this happen. You have to make this happen. And I could feel that his energy would start to go. And, in the moment, I wasn't making the connection. I wasn't really connecting the dots. But after 5, 6, 7, 10 iterations of this, finally, I just said, this dog is going to try to kill me if I don't get on top of this right now, right now. And I just had this image of myself as a flexible tree. I could bend, I could move. The wind could blow me, but I wasn't going to fall over and I wasn't going to break. And the more I dug into that image, the weaker and weaker and weaker the dog got, until finally it was like all the air was out of the balloon. He went just like that. And it was over. It was absolutely over. He just walked along beside me. I walked him over to his pen. He got a drink of water. I took him out again 10 minutes later. Perfect, all the way through. Perfect, all the way through. And, I did a lot of work with that dog who had been, unfortunately, the recipient of some very, very coercive, unfair training practices in Europe. And we worked through that. So men were a trigger for him. He had a lot of traumatic stuff about his neck. Like any jerk on a neck. He was the kind of animal where you had to be fair. You had to be fair. If you gave him a correction, it had to be communicated in a way so that he knew exactly why. And then there was never a problem. He had a very, very long career, was retired, and is living now very happily with the handler that he had for over 10 years and her children. Wonderful, wonderful dog. So that was the very, very beginning for me. A few years down the road, I was able to work with a marvelous German Shepherd female that I owned, that I was titling for her work in protection, scent work, and obedience. And it was just a beautiful time of year. I would put her in the car. We would drive to a field not too far from my home. We'd work. And at some point in the day, I would think to myself, all right, it's really time to wrap it up. And after about a week or so, when I would get that thought, no matter what she was doing, she would stop what she was doing and go pick up some of the training materials and go to the car. Honestly. And I was like, all right, we're going to do a study, right? We're going to do a study. And I tried so hard to contain my physical movements, which is a lot harder than you would think it would be. It's not just body, it's face, it's eyes, am I blinking, am I doing anything at all? I finally ended up turning my back completely and having the thought, and she would never miss the cue. Never, ever miss the cue. So that really started me on a long road. It's 12 years, I'm into it now, of really trying to work with animals, not only like they're a black box and, you know, here's the stimulus, and where there's a response, there'll either be a reward or a correction, or a reward or a non-reward, to communicating energetically with these amazing creatures. And it's been quite a road. It really has been quite a road. I've learned many, many, many things from dogs. And when I learned about EFT, it blew it wide open for me. Because what EFT does for me as a handler and a trainer is it gets my junk out of the way so that I can hear. Now, I have become a canine intuitive. I can communicate with animals, dogs, cats a little bit. My parrot, all she ever wants to say to me is, I don't like you. So I don't really do birds too much. I wish that's true, actually. But the reason that I'm able to do that is like this. Like Angie said, it's sort of tuning in. The first thing is to really set the intention, as we would do with any EFT work, right? We set the intention that whatever comes out of the communication will be used for the best and highest good of the animal and the people who love it, right? And that I would try my best, and I would offer this, that I will try my best to be as good a reporter as I can possibly be. And for me, it's like this. It's the same thing as going into a crowded room, and there's a lot of conversation, there's a hum, and all of a sudden you catch the thread of a conversation that, like, wow. And then you listen a little more, and all of a sudden you can hear almost everything that's being said, despite the babble in the room, which is suddenly dropped away to nothing. For me, what I see are pictures more than anything else. You know, animals, dogs particularly, communicate in pictures, especially their traumatic moments. And I do want to offer this. Like, a lot of people have rescued dogs, and there's so much more understanding of the plight of animals who need to be rescued. Almost everybody I know who owns dogs, multiple dogs, has a couple of rescues. And more dogs, in my opinion, have been traumatized by well-meaning humans than by people who truly were neglectful or overtly harmful. So that goes a lot farther in terms of our responsibility to dogs than normally we would have thought of. So here's something that I want to just put out there. So when we're approaching an animal, or when someone has contacted me because there's a problem or they perceive some need, the very first words they use with me are usually very telling. So when the person says, you know, my dog has a problem with barking versus, you know, I'm having a problem with my dog, it's a very different perception. It's a very, very different sort of paradigmatic approach. When somebody has already opted in to the idea that something that I'm doing or not doing is probably going to influence what has happened, what is happening, and what's going to happen. That's a tremendous, tremendous difference. Our perceptions when we approach animals are really the key, ultimately, I believe, to true success. Because if we can't somehow set aside the perceptual filters that we all have, things that we grew up with, things that we're embarrassed about, whatever it is that makes a problem, I'm embarrassed, I feel like a failure, I feel like the dog doesn't appreciate me, I never wanted this damn dog in the first place, I got it from my kids and now, you know, they're not helping me. There are many, many things that factor into that. Until the owner or the person can really step away from that to see, to observe exactly what the behavior is, what may be a precipitating factor, what the triggers are, and how people sometimes inadvertently play into it and allow it to continue. Here's an example, and it's very similar to the story that Angie told about the woman who had the problem with her child. I've been working for quite a while with a woman who has a bulldog that bites. And he's bitten about 11 people. And most owners would have euthanized a dog by that point. That's not an option for her. What we've come to determine over the course of our work together is that she's a single woman. And her original complaint to me was, you know, I have this dog. He bites. I can't have people over at my house. I can't take him out. I can't get a dog walker for him because I'm afraid. I'm literally a prisoner in my own life, in my own house, because of my dog, whom I love, and I'm not going to get rid of him. So we have to do something about this problem. So as we worked and as we tapped and tapped and tapped and tapped, there were many, many things that came out from her. What I kept getting from the dog, whose name is Otto, was, she needs me to be this way. She needs me to be this way. She needs me to be this way. And I mean, he's not a real, like, some dogs are real communicators. He was like, this is it. This is the whole story. Do something about it. Will you just do something about it? And when I gently tried to introduce the possibility that his behavior was something that she was perhaps unconsciously motivating and needing. Wow, that like blew the lid off everything. Absolutely blew the lid off everything. It kind of did blew things up completely for about a month. Well, she was furious with me. How can you even suggest that after all this time? Do you have any idea how much money I cry every day because of this dog? How can you possibly be suggesting that I need this, or I want this, or I'm creating it? I mean, she just couldn't handle it. And it, you know, I delivered it as gently as I could. Yeah. Oh, you're just stretching? Okay. Oh, 10, okay. Got it. So ultimately, she was able, because her love for this dog really was so pure, she was able to address that, and then it became more work and more work and more work. When people who work with animals say, you know, we have to work on both ends, you know, who's holding the reins, who's holding the leash, this is really absolutely key component. Absolutely key component. With her, she basically realized that her own fear and anxiety about fully entering life as an adult woman was what was keeping her. And because she didn't want to address that directly, she projected her need to have a reason to stay home on her dog. And that was the contract that they sort of had. That was the energetic contract that they had. And I've seen that kind of thing over and over and over again. Yep. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'll do tapping on dogs. My experience with dogs is most dogs don't like tapping that much. It's right. You had that experience too?
Yes, I have a dog.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. She's just being overstimulated. She's just being overstimulated.
Yeah, that was what it was. Now it's a little bit.
Right, right. Also with a lot of dogs who are very poor physically sensitive along certain median lines, a tap, pat, 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 is much more easily received than stroking. Because what most people do, instead of a stroke top to bottom and then top to bottom, is like back and forth and back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And if somebody was doing that to my head, I'd be like, get the hell off me, right? Don't do that. That's rude. You know, I don't like it. But that's sort of that's what's going on with her. So. No, she's just being overstimulated. Marilyn? I actually brought this picture because I was hoping we could spend maybe just a couple minutes talking about how to do surrogate tapping on a dog. Let me just answer your question real quick. Somebody else have a question? Oh, we're good. Mm-hmm. That, again, depends on the animal. Most animals are okay touching their chest. Of almost any species, chest is okay. You know, I've tapped on guinea pigs, and you know, they'll take it in the chest, touch their face, like, wah! And you look. Again, anything, you know, because this is like very intimate space, you know, for all, you know, for all animals. Mm-hmm. Right. Right. So I'm gonna just put this up here for a second and talk about surrogate tapping for him. Okay. So I was called a couple of days ago by the owners of this dog, who is a 14-year-old Weimaraner. 14. His cataracts a little bit on the eyes, but he can still see. About 4 months ago, he lost his lifetime canine companion, a Vishla by the name of Sailor. And since then, this dog's a wreck. And the reason that I got a call was not because the dog was a wreck. I got a call because the dog being a wreck created, I can't go out of my house, from the owner. Okay? So what I did with this guy, was we just, the whole, you know, toolbox. We just did some simple desensitization about crates with lots of rewards, quick in, quick out, desensitized to picking up the keys, desensitized to picking up a purse, the door, anything that might be a trigger. But there was still such an undertone of sadness in this guy, right? Such an undertone of sadness. And with animals, almost all their issues are like archetypal in strength. So it's primal loss. It's primal fear of abandonment. It's primal terror. It's very, very powerful. And it, like little kids, really, you know, like little kids. Like, there's not a whole lot of, like, softening or, you know, sideways steps with it. I mean, it is what it is. And they're really up straight about it. So this was the sadness with this guy. Missing his canine companion. And afraid, just horrible fear of abandonment. Horrible fear of abandonment. So when we do surrogate tapping with dogs, it sort of goes like this. if the owner is present and can step away from their ego-related issues enough to be observant, we have the owner tap and speak about the dog. So it's third person, then second person, then first person, right? 3, 2, 1 is the easiest way to remember it. Okay, so first we're speaking about Spooner. So I'll do that. Okay? So this is Spooner. As you know, he's an absolutely beautiful Weimaraner. 14-year-old boy, he's been through a lot. He's a good dog. He misses his companion terribly. And now, kind of as a result of that, I think, when his owner decides that she needs to leave the house to go to work, go to the grocery store, or whatever, he has a very hard time with it. He's torn apart his crates. He's torn apart sofas. you know, he loses control of his bodily functions. He howls pitifully when he's left alone. But he is a really good dog. He's been a great companion his whole life. He's brave. He's strong. He's had many surgeries for many things. He's lived on boats and docks and things like that. He's a great swimmer. He's got great nerves. So that's Scooter. And I'm just going to tap a full round on this issue. Scooter's a good dog. He's a good dog. He's a good dog. He's a very good dog. He's struggling right now with a couple of issues. He really misses his friend, Sailor. He misses his friend, Sailor. He misses his friend, Sailor. He's afraid. 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 Now, this is an abbreviated thing, okay. What we do next is speak to Scooter. Anybody game? Anybody want to try? Speak to him. So we're going to tap as you speak to him about what your concerns are, why you're worried about him, you're worried about what he's doing to himself, why he doesn't have to worry about it. We can do it as a group, or I can lead it. How are we doing for time, by the way? I don't want to kill time here. All right, I better lead it then. Okay. Okay, so everybody's got their pictures. So, Scooter. Buddy. Buddy. Oh. We're worried about you so much. We know you're scared. Don't really know what to do for you. This is new stuff for your owners. They want you to be happy. They want you to know how much they love you, how much they care for you, how devoted they are to you. They will never leave 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 you. Pilot had to go. Sailor had to go. It was her turn. She wanted to go. She needed to leave her body. She needed to leave her body. This is a natural thing. But she's really not gone. So she's not in her body right now. She's not in her body. But we think about her. And we still love her. Just the way we love you. And we will never leave you. We will never leave you. Dear companion and friend, and we will do whatever it takes to try to help you feel more comfortable, to make you feel safe, to make you feel safe, to make you feel safe. Sorry about that. Okay, the last one, okay, first person, Scooter speaks. Scooter speaks. Okay. Does anybody want to try that? Sure.
I'll keep out there. Okay.
I get it.
I
get it.
It's a female. She likes me. She loves me. I'm a salesman. She loves me. She loves me. I'm a salesman.
I'm afraid. I don't feel safe. Sailor left. I don't understand it yet. I don't get it. Everything seems like it's supposed to be back to normal. It's not normal. She's not here. How come they don't act like she's not here? I don't get it. I don't get it. They leave me alone. I've never been alone before. I've never been alone before my whole life. She was here when I showed up as a puppy. I was alone. She left and was alone. Now, dogs are pack animals. Horses are herd animals. For them, alone equals death. It does. It's the scariest thing to do. It's the scariest thing to do. Now, what I would do, we only have 1 minute left, but I'm going to do this. You need to leave. But energetically, we have to finish it. Okay? So, I'm going to speak to Schooner. Schooner. I feel so sorry for your distress. I'm looking for a way for something to do that will help you with this. That will definitely help you with your feeling of loneliness. So if there's something that you want to tell me, please tell me. Please tell me. I'm listening. I'm listening.
I gotta tell you, I don't get it. And that would be ideal.
Maybe at some point you'll let us know when you're ready for a companion, if that would help you. Maybe you would let us know. Maybe you'll let us know. But we love you. We care about you. We care about your distress. We suffer with you. We miss Sailor too. We have to work as humans. So sometimes we have to work even when our hearts are broken. When our hearts were broken. We love you. We love you. This is like very, very compressed and a little different the way it usually came out. But he actually is pretty much, I'd say 70% of the way there. So we're trying to
as you were doing your work as well, did you notice any physical changes from him? Did you notice him to be more relaxed?
By the time I started really doing the energetic work in the house, I started actually with his owner first, who was, her stress level was off the chart. So we just did like a couple, I can't even tell you how many rounds, we just tap and breathe, because she couldn't talk about the loss of the dog. She couldn't talk about the fact that this guy's 14, you know, and that's a stressor for her. We just did lots of tap and breathe until she could get like back into herself, you know, and then she was able to really do beautiful work with him, just, you know, guided tapping. She was very, very convinced.
But thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you.